to the end of the first phase of the Can be resources to build fields, but with the right changes in order to make them profitable. By which I mean that they would be the dysfunction that's given to them to not be added in order. The new reform bill would improve the power for the government to change in the law in order to ensure that every EU member is profitable. It's the work of the Declaration that would allow for the implementation of all other agreements with respect to devoted EU exits. However, that may have yet begun in the context of a reform and implementation bill, as the UK and allied it to do. In order to get a complete understanding of which rules apply to Gibraltar, we have examined in excess of 20,000 pieces of legislation. Taken together, this comprises the legal order of the European Union, and these are principally the treaties, regulations, decisions, and directives. We have also undertaken an examination of our entire textbook in order to identify where individually EU measures are to be implemented or transposed. We are working on a basis of a core of about 1,600 measures, which are relevant and need to be individually considered by the various government departments and the legislative drafters. That exercise is already underway. This is perhaps the most far-reaching legislative review ever undertaken in Gibraltar, relatively a mammoth task, and the government is very grateful to everyone involved in the exercise. We think a well-presented to our departure from the European Union and the final head 12, some head 2, 9. I now want to report on our office in Brussels. Not surprisingly, our EU representation is itself heavily involved in different aspects of work as we prepare to leave the European Union. Therefore, the office today is busier than it has ever been as a result of the ongoing Article 15 process. In addition to the business as usual work that they conduct to other demands and the challenges we collectively face as a consequence of Brexit, the office continues to gather vital intelligence on the ground in Brussels. It has been pivotal in informing the government of developments in each of the EU institutions concerning Brexit. It has been a great interest to have the vote of decision in a set of matters that are of critical relevance to us. The voting method of contacts and supporters continues to grow. And to know that this is something which does not escape the attention of Madrid. The former Senator Gibraltar Group is now consolidated and relationships are being maintained on a day-to-day basis. Interest in Brussels about Gibraltar matters has never been greater. This is, of course, due to an increasing awareness of opposition in these negotiations. However, the work of our office in Brussels in generating this interest should not be underestimated. Over the last 12 months, I have visited Brussels on three occasions, once with the Chief Minister in July last year. The Attorney General has made several visits to him again. Our representation has been closely involved in all these visits and has been instrumental in securing meetings. The European Parliament will have a final say on the outcome of the negotiations for the departure of the United Kingdom and Gibraltar from the European Union. It will have a vote on whether to approve or reject the withdrawal agreement. For this reason, the team in Brussels has dedicated much time the work of briefing members of the European Parliament on the voter Brexit issue. In the 2017 calendar year, the Gibraltar government officials or ministers met informally with 79 MEPs of different nationalities, from different committees, and from different political parties. Since the 1st of January 2018, to date, 40 more MEPs have been seen. Meetings with some of these MEPs have taken place on more than one occasion. This means that the number of separate meetings is in fact much higher. Records of every single meeting are kept. In the legislative meeting, there is a purpose, an objective, and a reason for the approach. Many MEPs concerned are among the most influential and experienced members of the European Parliament. Some are the chairs of parliamentary committees, which are most relevant to the voter. By way of example, the government can confirm that it has exchanged views with each and every MEP forming part of the European Parliament's Brexit steering group. This is a group that is coordinating and defining the Parliament's policy as the Article 15 process moves forward. At times, this strategic lobbying translates into results that are measurable and tangible. The House will recall how an amendment of the voter was tabled by Senate MEPs following an inquiry into money laundering, tax avoidance, and tax evasion. Those amendments were highlighted prominently in the science press. Predictably, that same science press was work, come back and drop them to the business that find our presence there. The government at the same time continues with its program of organizing and supporting visits for anything to the water. We are still welcome 9 different members of the European Parliament. We have also had direct contact with the European Commission. On the 30th of July 2017, the Commissioner and the Chief Minister and I met with the EU Deputy Chief Brexit Negotiator, Sabine Wayans, and other members of the team. This was the same day that Task Force 52 met with the First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, and the First Minister of Wales, Colin Jones, and the Opposition Leader in the UK, Jeremy Corbyn. The meeting took place despite intense and desperate efforts from Madrid to prevent it from happening. It proved to be a good opportunity to explain the voters' objectives and confirm it. I would like to pledge to stay brief again with the UK Commissioner, Sir Julian King, later this year. Further meetings with Commission officials belonging to different Directorates General have taken place over the last 12 months. The purpose of those meetings has been to discuss issues relevant for ongoing membership of the EU and a continual obligation to preserve and implement EU law. As part of our policy to leave no stone unturned, as we leave the EU, we have met with every single member state. These meetings are taking place in Brussels, in London, and here in the Baltic. Meetings have also taken place with the Council officials coordinating Brexit matters. We also understand that it is not in the public interest to disseminate detailed information concerning some of the contacts that have taken place. Communications with the UK's own representation to the EU Parliament has also been fluid at all levels. It's worth highlighting that in January, I had a very productive meeting with the UK Permanent Minister to the EU Between Barrow and a separate meeting with newly appointed Director General for the UK EU Partnership, Javier Vidal. I am confident that the voters' concerns and priorities are highly understood by the UK officials in Brussels. I know that we look to them to continue to defend our interests in the heart of the EU on a day-to-day basis. Mr. Speaker, aside from the above, the Office of Brussels continues to monitor and advise on the EU legislative and non-legislative proposals. It has also been involved with the following. 1. Keeping up to speed with the developments in Brussels in fintech and DLT technology, working in conjunction with finance and the department and the Financial Services Commission. The Office is also right to organize visits to Brussels for this purpose, ensuring that the voter is well represented in prominent debates and discussions. 2. Arranging for meetings to make the voter's case and Brussels policy think tank. 3. Conducting 2 visits to Brussels to coincide with the European Parliament plenary session there, with a further visit of British later this month. 4. Organizing and accompanying 3 visits of MEP assistance to Gibraltar, the last one took place just over a week ago. 5. Making arrangements for the October 2017 visit of the voter students to Brussels. 6. Assisting in an event hosted in the voter house to inaugurate the Friends of the Voter Group, as well as hosting events with the voter ombudsman, the Young Professionals in Foreign Policy Group, Team Global, and the British Irish Parliamentary Assembly. Attending the big tent networking events organized by other representations and organizations, as well as conferences in Brussels, takes up another part of their time. The government is grateful to Graham Watson, to Daniel D'Amato, and to the team there for the work that they continue to do. The Brussels office can be found at head 12, subhead 2, team B. Mr. Speaker, I now move on to the Voter House in London. The expanding diversity of different talents and arising as the closely of leading vision to unfold has also continued to dominate work at the Voter House in London. This is in addition to the important task of logging and keeping our independent supporters in Westminster accurately informed. The Office is trying to provide an effective working platform from which the government can interact with ministers and officials in London. As a guide established for the UK and the voice departure from the EU approach, engagement at a technical level has increased, alongside the broader and intense political discussions that continue. This is meant to working groups and Gibraltar meeting regularly with their UK counterparts in London. Some of those meetings alternate between Whitehall and Gibraltar House itself. The efforts that have been established and the detailed technical work that results from this engagement will become increasingly important to us as we leave the European Union. that the Christian founder of this book would expand and explain to me. This piece on the road is no information and examining of contact in both directions has been an important element in the work carried out in London. It was passed out of the road over the last couple of years. It has become the conduit for information gathering and analysis. It has been the principal station to Walter and Brexit's intent and events in London. It has engaged with UK government departments and officials. It helps to organise the flow of information into number 6 and to the government here, into Walter. Mr. Matthews now attends parliamentary committee in hearing. The engaged MEPs and committee members will respect the Walter to put forward its views and concerns. Their work with both Houses of Parliament is very much a priority. Gibraltar House assists the All Party Parliamentary Group on Gibraltar with its secretarial function. It reaches out to the MPs and peers to show an interest in Gibraltar affairs. Bob Neal and Peter Grover, the chair of the All Party Gibraltar Group, ACPG, on Gibraltar a year ago. He has been an important ally in getting the Doc's message across to the right people in number 10 and in the right form. The ACPG is a cross-party body, which includes MPs and peers. Members have assumed that Gibraltar has enjoyed considerable support in debate and other parliamentary activities. Raymond and I are sure the whole and the federal house is very grateful to Bob and to our friends in the ACPG. Mr. Speaker, the government has been active in putting across our views in Westminster as well. My colleague, the Chief Minister, has appeared before both the House of Commons Committee on Exiting the European Union, chaired by Henry Dunn, and afterwards the European Union Committee chaired by Lord Boswell. Members were able to record that in March this year, Lord Boswell led a small delegation from the committee to see the situation in Gibraltar at first hand. It has been an important for the government to foster the support and loyalty we have enjoyed from many British MPs and peers. Close friends like Deputy Speaker Vincent Boyle and his father, Lord Boyle, are fine examples of their continued loyalty and support. But at the same time, we continue to reach out to new friends. We must get a message across and win support based on the merits of the voter's case. Mr. Speaker, I would like to say a few words about the vote today. The annual vote today event in London has been transformed. The numbers for the evening reception have been reduced considerably. Invitations are now far more targeted. Last year, the evening reception was hosted at the Griffin on Monday, the 23rd of October. Among the guests were 10 ambassadors and 13 deputy ambassadors, as well as some 36 members of the House of Commons and the House of Lords. The government also hosted 100 members of the Gibraltar expatriate community for Thanksgiving Mass and reception in Fulham on the preceding day. Over 300 members of the Gibraltar Financial Services Industry Metro Business Bank in the City of London. The new focus given to more targeted events provide greater value for money. The number of political guests at the last National Day rally is a reflection of the political moment that we find ourselves in. The vote has very close to 26 MPs and peers from across the UK Parliament. 5 members of the European Parliament also joined us. Their program includes separate briefings from the Chief Minister and from me. The representatives will make a meeting with representatives in the Finance Centre, a call on his excellency the Governor. Delegates attended the traditional National Day rally. We were also able to participate in a number of events marking the 50th anniversary of the 1967 referendum. It was a real pleasure to welcome the UK Minister for Europe, Darren Duncan, to the Voter. This referendum is a continuous process. Only this spring, the London office organised a breakfast meeting with the Chief Minister for the All Party Voter Group in the House of Commons. This was attended by 17 MPs. On the same day, and almost exactly the same time, I also got another group of MPs here in Gibraltar. We believe that such visits are crucial in deepening our understanding of the issues and challenges before us. There is no better way to understand Gibraltar than to visit Gibraltar. Those of the MPs who came here on working visits outside National Day include Dominic Green, Liz McInnes, Robert Goodwin, Mike Gates, and Tom Brake. Mr. Speaker, our former governors continue to represent a great source of support and the many close contacts with the team in London. The London office also has a fluid relationship with the Scottish, Welsh, and Northern Irish Assembly representatives. visited many embassies in London, including ambassadors of the European Union countries. Many member states agree you have a particular interest in how Brexit may impact on Gibraltar. Our UK representative, Dominic Sowell, is regularly invited to official and diplomatic events in the capital, in addition to formal working meetings. This is that the webbing work continues. The council has normally been the detailed party conference season. 2017 saw a record participation in such events. Gibraltar maintained its traditional setting at the Conservative, Labour, and Liberal Democrat conferences. Gibraltar also stands at the conference of the First National Party. In the same way, we attended the DUP conference in Belfast for the very first time. Gibraltar hosted a reception for lunch every Sunday. The high-profile speakers in these events reflect the support that Gibraltar enjoys right to the top of the UK political establishment. At the Conservative Conference, we had the Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson. At the Labour Conference, we had Shadow Foreign Secretary, Emily Thornberry. At the Liberal Democrat Conference, we had the Deputy Leader, Joe Simpson. At the SNP Conference, we had the Spokesman on International Affairs and Europe, Stephen Greffins. And at the DUP, we have the leader and former First Minister, Arlene Foster. It's become the meditate of friends for granted. The government will continue to work closely with them. We will continue to reach out to all layers of public opinion in the UK. We shall continue to consolidate and grow our support in Westminster. I will add here that Gibraltar was represented at the State of the Parliament that followed the last UK general election. We took our seats alongside ambassadors and representatives of other British overseas territories. In this context, it is important to recall that Gibraltar, the Association of the Territories, continues to be an integral part of our working under. Gibraltar House is a regular venue for its meetings. I think that all of us will be affected in different ways as we leave the European Union. Despite these differences, the territory has much to gain from standing in solidarity with one another. Mr. Speaker, as we leave the European Union and one door closes, other doors will open. Gibraltar, like the United Kingdom itself, is looking for closer interaction with the Commonwealth. This year, on Commonwealth Day, we lowered the flag of the European Union and replaced it with the flag of the Commonwealth. This was an important symbolic gesture, a prelude of things to come. Gibraltar has long relished its historic relationship with the Commonwealth family. This year, we attended a number of different fora around the Commonwealth heads of government meeting in London. We were represented at the Commonwealth Youth Forum, the Commonwealth Business Forum, the Commonwealth People's Forum, and the Commonwealth Women's Forum. These engagements all proved to be very useful. Indeed, the young people who attended the Youth Forum were able to speak directly to the leaders of Commonwealth countries like Canada and Jamaica, as well as to the Prime Minister to the UK. In 2018, Gibraltar also went to the Commonwealth Youth Parliament for the first time. This event took place in Jersey, and once again, our young people did very well. In April, the Gibraltar flag flew proudly next to those of 70 other territories and countries during the Commonwealth Games in Gold Coast, Australia. At the time, Gibraltar has continued its long-standing contact with the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association. The Minister for Equality, Samantha Sacramento, is a member of the board of the Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians. The Minister for Culture, Timothy Harris, is now an alternate to the board of the Commonwealth Local Government Forum. Since over summer, I've stepped up our engagement with the Commonwealth Centre for Telecommunications Union. Gibraltar has now joined the Commonwealth Enterprise and Investment Council. Earlier this year, I met with the Secretary General of the Commonwealth, Diana Scotland, at her offices in Marlborough Palace. I also met with the UK Minister for the Commonwealth, the Gatmark of Wimbledon. Gibraltar will continue to reinvigorate our institutional links with the Commonwealth in the months and years to come. The Federal Government maintains a strong relationship with the Royal Household, through the Gibraltar House in London. This includes representation and attendance by Gibraltar at key ceremonial events, including the annual Commonwealth Month. The government is working to include Gibraltar in one of the national programs known as the Commonwealth Walkway. My colleague, the Minister for the Environment, is leading on this matter. Last year, for the first royal visit to Gibraltar House, London. On the 16th of October, the Chief Minister hosted Her Royal Highness, the Prince Royal, to a reception there to intend that Gibraltar continues to provide welcome support. They met regularly to the facilities at Gibraltar House. This is in addition to the considerable use of the building by the finance center, by commercial and legal firms, as well as government departments and bodies. At this opportunity, we found Dominic Sherry, Tyson Bradley, and the staff at Gibraltar House. They are Gibraltar's place in London, and they continue to fulfill this role extremely well. Gibraltar House can be found at head 12, suburb 2-2A. Mr. Speaker, the office in Hong Kong works directly to my colleagues, the Minister for Commerce and the Minister for Economic Development. The Hong Kong office, as I previously explained, has been included within my head truly for administrative purposes, together with the other two Gibraltar offices abroad. Since establishing our office in April 2014, the aim has always been to promote, protect, and further Gibraltar's interests in the Far East. This is the fastest growing economic region in the world. We have hosted numerous Gibraltar delegations led by ministers and private sector firms in China, and also introduced many firms from Asia to Gibraltar. It has driven significant media coverage in the region promoting Gibraltar as a jurisdiction. Private meetings with businessmen, regulators, and officials have also been managed by the Gibraltar by the office in Hong Kong. This includes arrangements for a memorandum of understanding to be signed by the GFSC with the Hong Kong regulators related to our drive to attract DLC business to Gibraltar. The government is working hand in hand with the private sector to foster and promote Gibraltar's reputation as an attractive, safe, and economically advantageous jurisdiction in which to conduct international business. Mr. Speaker, it is clear to the House that the role of this office is commercial and not political. I therefore need my colleagues to provide more details about its operation. The Hong Kong office is located at head 12, suburb 2-2C. Mr. Speaker, I have to say a few words about the government's lobbying activities in Washington. Gibraltar and Spain have been engaged in a game of cat and mouse in Washington for a number of years. This started with the Spanish government at the time stepped out of anti-Gibraltar rhetoric. They wrote to and met with members of Congress to stand up for resolution supporting Gibraltar. They have complained to their congressmen and congresswomen who have visited Gibraltar. They have protested to members of the Congress and Senate Committee on External Relations. They have also protested to their congressmen who have met with us to inaugurate to Washington. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, they have been known to protest to congressional offices even before such meetings have taken place, and when a statement has not been published. Quite remarkable. Member of Spain's efforts have proved to be completely counterproductive. A senior congressman told us that no third party would dictate to him who he can or cannot meet. Other officers were curious to find out how Spain knew about our meetings in the first place. Despite his work on the action, it became necessary to counter the misinformation against the voter input across China Grid in the US government. This happens in several ways. First, Mr. Speaker, our lobbyist following night has held over 100 meetings with congressional officers in the House and in the Senate, including with senior officials in the Trump administration and multiple other communications. Secondly, the entire members of Congress and the U.S. Armed Services to visit Gibraltar, so you can appreciate our reality for themselves. In August, we hosted a visit by U.S. Congressmen and staffers in front of the United Kingdom's Nika scheme. That visit included two Republican congressmen and one Democrat. There were also two senators to the staff, four congressmen to the staff, and two other staffers. There were two other visits during 2017. One visit was composed of three members of Congress, including the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee and the senior ranking Democrat on the Defense Subcommittee. Then a visit consisted of Representative Sanchez and Representative Needham, who came to the voters for an event organized by the American Chamber of Commerce and Trump. This year, we were delighted to welcome other delegations from the Appropriations Committee, which included a member of the U.S. Air Force and of the U.S. Navy. Mr. Speaker, the third way in which we counter Spain's propaganda is by making our own lobbying visits to Washington. We involve very tight surgery, dropping down to over 20 meetings in 2 full days. I also know that Congressman George Holden tabled a resolution which salutes the long-standing and historic relationship between Gibraltar and the United States. It also supports the right to self-determination as the UK overseas territory. This started with 6 members of Congress. I reported up there that there were now 27. I'm pleased to tell the House that this support has now increased by the Senate to 47 members of Congress. result of the vote of Oxford and engagement with the US Congress and Executive Branch, there is now a broader appreciation of opposition. Several congressional leaders are concerned that they will take advantage of Brexit in order to advance the integrity plan. Some of them have advised them against it. A reflection of the status quo in this part of the Mediterranean is in nobody's interest. For our part, the government will continue to present our side of the argument in Washington, and in that way, set the level straight. Mr. Speaker, it is relevant that the state of those who work about Spain and Spanish policy towards the border. In Belgium, I am conscious that there was a change of government in Madrid a few weeks ago. So much of what I have to say clearly relates to the changes before that. I also want to make it clear that a government in Spain itself has been led by the Chief Minister and his office. That said, I have also engaged Spanish political parties except for that leader of the West in those places like Brussels. Should the freedom continue to strive to understand Spanish policy beyond towards us, beyond its often noisy manifestations in the media? It remains a long-standing hope that progressive socio-political currents will one day form in Spain. If this doesn't happen, it might become possible to Spain to find this gap as we see ourselves. This could be the basis for a fruitful partnership in areas of the same interests and the same concerns. In the meantime, we remain alert to any policies and actions designed to fight greater identity, our constitutional order, or our economy. The vast majority of ordinary Spaniards are too busy with the realities affecting their daily lives to think about the future. But it's part of the Spanish machinery of government that formulates its security policy and strategy to continue to regard the border as an anomaly at best and a threat at worst. Two examples in different areas would serve to exemplify this attitude. Each year, Spain conducts a major maritime security and safety exercise known as MARSEC. This year, MARSEC took place from the 14th to the 25th of May. The aim of MARSEC is to improve the coordination between the Spanish Navy and all the national and autonomous bodies involved in maritime safety and security. It is an important exercise on good health, security and safety of mariners and cargo as it comes to the region. And fortunately, the exercise also acted as a backdrop for Spanish naval incursions into Beijing today. This occurred just before the exercise started on the 12th of May and again on the 15th of May. Our friends in the Royal Navy seem to be also confident proportionately and with immaculate professionalism. However, the incident on the 12th of May also required the attention of our own vessel traffic services. They had to work with the patrol vessel of Saviola to change its course for the sake of safety of navigation, as the vessel was inbound from the river point towards our pilot station in the Western Anchorage at that time. These incidents are unnecessary, unfortunate, and potentially dangerous. But they occur because of the Spanish Navy's insistence in seeing us as a threat rather than as potential partners. The second example relates to the routine allegations that Gibraltar is a center for money laundering. Spanish judge Jose Pina Gonzalez is a special prosecutor who has dedicated much of his professional career towards tackling the drug long-standing practice in Spain by Western organized crime. Judge Pina is rightly lauded for his work. However, on the 25th of May, while delivering a talk about his work at the Hartford Institute, a prestigious think tank in Washington, Jack Green that claimed Gibraltar is an example of a non-cooperative territory which was not transferred. He said that Gibraltar was temporarily British. He then was considered by Spain as a non-cooperating territory. He said that we are used by international criminal organizations to hide the West. Gibraltar was the only example he gave. Mr. Speaker, this is naked disinformation. It is intended to make out that Gibraltar is a security threat. It is vital enough that this threat are not manufactured by more hardline elements between the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the State Department. This is the kind of disinformation we have to counter in Washington. Gibraltar will continue to extend the hand of cooperation and partnership towards our neighbors. The government continues to hope that these changes take place in Spain that might form the basis for a successful partnership in areas of mutual interest and concern. And now we're going to speak of civil aviation. As I said earlier, there have been discussions with Spain on the enhanced use of the Gibraltar Airport. These discussions follow on from our planned departure from the European Union. they do not involve sovereignty, jurisdiction, and control. They involve EU exit matters. But the fact that the EU will change the dynamics of the world trade traditions as we have traditionally known them to be. Therefore, agreements in 1987 and again in 2006 made provision for the application of the EU law on civil aviation to the world trade. They are applied automatically and without question before 1987. In 1987, the World Trade Airport was suspended from the EU aviation acquis. In 2006, that suspension was lifted. However, the position where we had once we had left the European Union would be markedly different. We will no longer be entitled to inclusion in EU civil aviation legislation by virtue of our membership of that organization. So, number one, we would cease to be a part of it. Our relationship will therefore have to be redefined. It is obvious to speak that the European Union has not sought to introduce any new aviation legislation during the past year, which includes a reference to the vote. A number of aspects may be blocked by Spain in the country. Clearly, there are some awaiting the UK's departure from the European Union next month before making their next move. The government has already said that the Bonn Agreement of 2006 provides a basis for discussion going forward. Indeed, it will be recalled that before turning office, the entire design of the air terminal was premised on the opening of access points on the south side. There are corridors, walls, escalators, lifts, and partitions that were put in place precisely in order to facilitate such dual access. Nonetheless, that agreement would itself need to be updated going forward, as the water would now be outside the EU while Spain would remain inside it. The view of the government, Mr. Speaker, is that the space between the red line of Gibraltar and the red line of Spain to produce a sensible way forward. That can only be in other businesses. The central power of the Socialist Party that signed the Gibraltar Agreement may assist in this effect. It is still too early to tell. In the meantime, the government continues its vigorous lobbying in the European Union in order to increase awareness of our citizens. Let me add that we have always enjoyed the full support of the UK government throughout. My colleague Gilbert Degouli, who has responsibility for commercial aviation, may comment further on the loss of Monarch Airlines following the collapse of the airline. I would like to concentrate on the repatriation efforts. We can see that passengers stranded in Gibraltar and the surrounding areas were efficiently repatriated to the United Kingdom. It could have been a nightmare scenario for the airport. However, gladly, the logistics of the airport proved to be a success. The coordination efforts between the air terminal director, the Register of Aviation, the UK CAA, the Convent, and different government entities worked extremely well. The evacuation of stranded passengers was conducted in an orderly manner and without significant problems. Mr. Speaker, the number of applications to fly an unmanned aircraft, otherwise known as a drone, have increased substantially. The number of drone permits issued in 2017 was 30. This is 6 times the number issued in 2016. In the first 5 months of this year, 25 have already been issued. Applications continue to rise. We will have 3 fully qualified drone operators. It would appear that business is booming for them, given the number of requests for their services. I would like to thank the Department for the Environment and all other stakeholders for the rapid turnaround of all the requests received. Mr. Speaker, this federal electric civil aviation has been consulted on a record number of applications for building projects. The new airport safeguarding proposals are working very well. The government has encouraged to see the number of developers who continue to engage with the electric civil aviation in advance of applications being submitted to town planning. This has resulted in support for development projects from the electric civil aviation and indeed from the energy authorities at our electric board. On occasions, aviation-related conditions have nonetheless been included in planning permits. Mr. Speaker, would like to congratulate and thank the Director of Civil Aviation for his focus for his support over the last year. The civil aviation vote included a Type 13 in the estimates of revenue and expenses. Mr. Speaker, the National Archives are included under the office of the Deputy Chief Minister. The program of digitization of the material of the archives continues. A significant amount of historical material has not only been digitized, it has now been put online and be accessed from anywhere in the world. There are 1,238 registered visitors who consult this website on regular basis. total of 19,994 votes from 123 countries have been registered on the website of the Gibraltar National Archives. The government has continued to support the archivist Anthony Gabriel. In 2017, he attended digital preservation workshops at Oxford University, where he was invited to speak on a global audience about our digitization and digital preservation program. In August, he attended a meeting of the Archives and Records Association of the United Kingdom and Ireland at Manchester. This included training in the set of archival science best practice in terms of conservation, digitization, and digital preservation. The Archivist was also organized a number of very successful outreach programs during the last financial year. This included an organized screening of original footage of the 1967 referendum and a film night of students at the University of Gibraltar. The latter was fully booked. The Speaker, on behalf of the government and I'm sure the whole House, I would like to congratulate Mr. Villanova and his team for the wonderful work they are doing. The preservation of our record of the past is told the key to the future. Therefore, the Archivist knows that we can continue to count on my personal support and the support of the government going forward. The Gibraltar National Archives are at 12, subject 1 and 2, 5. Mr. Speaker, the Archivist is assisting with events later this year to commemorate the end of World War I. This will include an exhibition of relevant historical material and photographs, which will take place in November. In addition to this, I am pleased to announce that Gibraltar will be taking part in the UK There But Not There charity campaign. There But Not There is a charity project which is chosen to mark the 1918 armistice that put an end to a bloody conflict. It is a continued commemoration of the end of World War I. This is supposed to be the war to end all wars. Their objective is for individuals and organizations to purchase and install silhouettes of World War I soldiers in order to commemorate the fallen. In a way, the charity seeks to educate different generations about the ultimate sacrifice that was made. These silhouettes are available in different sizes. The government will be purchasing a number of life-size models. These will be purchased and placed at different public buildings. In addition to this, the government has offered as part of the commemoration to project a silhouette image of a World War I soldier onto the north face of the rock during the week of Ramadan Sunday. This initiative was warmly welcomed in the United Kingdom. This year, the Remembrance Sunday and Armistice Day coincide on the same day. Mr. Speaker, part of those commemorations, a book reflecting the role that Gibraltar played during World War I, will be published by Gardner Press. The book was written by Rear Admiral Albert Midland, and this is a memoir of his time as a commander of U.S. Navy ships based at Gibraltar in 1917-19. It carries an introduction by Professor John Hattinger, who is an Ernest J. Gibbons Professor Emeritus of Maritime History at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. Professor Hattinger discovered that Daniel's account of the U.S. Navy at Gibraltar, which had gone unnoticed for several decades. The professor is a member of the Gibraltar American Council. The wear of 14 U.S. vessels and 4,000 U.S. sailors based at Gibraltar during World War I. Their role was split with convoys in and out of the Mediterranean and elsewhere. The book makes it clear that Gibraltar became the principal convoy port of the world, with over one quarter of all Allied tonnage touching here in order to be organized into convoys in every direction. Indeed, they welcomed the American War Memorial in Man War Road with a statue gift from the United States of America precisely for the pivotal role that Gibraltar played. The speaker very much looks forward to the launch of the book. As promised in previous years, the government continues to invest in our urban fabric and our unique heritage. We are focused on several historical sites. Many have been conserved, restored, and are now open for the general public to enjoy. My colleague, the Minister for Heritage and for the Upper Rectorate, Dr. John Cotter, has spearheaded those improvements. The government at the same time will continue to improve and restore the northern defences. Our dedication in bringing back to life the British lands, the Queen's lands, and the King's lands remains unwavering. This project will continue to receive the funding from the budget, which is rightfully so. Canada Battery has now been cleared. About 50% of the Queen's lands have been cleaned. The government intends to focus our attention this year in not only removing debris from those lands, but in providing utility infrastructure to the site. Works in previous years have exposed an extensive area of the area and the organiser of the Heritage Trust and supported by London Biases. We have proved to be extremely popular. Ms. Peter, I would like to thank those members of the Heritage Trust for their time and their passion in presenting such facilities to the public. The government is also grateful to the Royal Engineers who continue to assist with these operations. It's their vision, well valued, special experience that making the site a unique event venue in the coming years. The Northern Defence has provided for and has run a tool project called 4ZZ10. Speaking of events, Mr. Speaker, the government plans to invest further in the Grand Battery, which links up to the Northern Defence. The exact timing is not yet clear, because this depends on the pace of the Northern Defence project itself. One of our most important battles stands at Foundry, Station 7 to the north. It is overlooked by the King's Landing in the Queensland. This battery currently has a cloud connection with a Royal Gibraltar Regiment based in Grand Battery House. The Minister and I have agreed with former regimental colonels to improve its external areas. This means that it can be better used to utilize as an event venue. Uplighting of the monument will be provided, damaged parts just repaired, and a hard surface introduced in some areas to provide a home for absolute battery. The site holds considerable historical value, as it has helped to define and shape our identity. Indeed, it has protected Gibraltar from the combined forces of France and Spain. In doing so, it has kept Gibraltar busy. It is an area which, thanks to the regiment, is unique to house events that are part of our community's social calendar. The beauty of our historical assets in this way provides a solid guarantee for their protection. For the reason that I have explained, there is an opening provision in the project at Head 102, subject 4ZZ2. In these more modern times, Mr. Speaker, the new battle line is in Europe. None of us back from leaving the European Union when the last general election took place. Yet today, that is the direction in which we are all headed. The sheer volume of work and the meetings that this has generated has, understandably, taken up a considerable proportion of the treatment of the time and of my own time. We are, as we said before, leaving nothing to chance. We are leaving no stone unturned. This is what we promised to do. It is physically and logistically impossible to deliver. At the same time, we are delivering on our objectives. New schools are now under construction. New low-cost housing projects are in the pipeline. New sporting facilities will remain for our enjoyment after the Ireland Games next year. And all this has happened in the shadow of Brexit and in the main against the background of the most hostile Spanish government that Gibraltar has known since the days of General Franco. This is in itself a considerable achievement. The Speaker has taken the opportunity to thank my personal staff in Convent Place for the support over the last year. I am also grateful to the staff of the Lands Office and to the management and staff of Land Property Services Limited. I also wish to take the opportunity to thank the clerk of the staff of Parliament and you too, Mr. Speaker, for your support. Thank you. This is our last battle of members of the European Union. By the end of this financial year, Gibraltar will no longer be part of the territory of the EU, and the external border of the EU will be the international frontier between our country and the Kingdom of Spain. I was president to the forces who were in 1972, Mr. Speaker. We were both here when we voted to join the EC in the bill that came to the House of Assembly. I'm sure we must hold some kind of record as having been part of the parliament that joined the EC and the parliament that is leading the House. I've seen it said that there is always a silver lining that we call power of God. I guess one silver lining. Although I said the external frontier of the EU is that Spain can no longer claim that it is a mere fence, whatever, as I like to call it, which we always call the frontier. So after Brexit, the EU enters this frontier, and what is on our side is not EU, and by definition, not Spain. A question that's about it is the land, which I think in 9 months' time, or that's it. So we are back where we were in 1973, geographically and politically. But now the world that we have been serving for 45 years has turned beyond imagination and in the world of economics driven by technology changed more than anything else. And this is the challenge we face. Mr. Speaker, as a leader of the opposition, Mr. Speaker frequently told my commitment to prudential control spending and to living within our means. Values which he claims are out there by the GOP which he led. This has always been my hallmark in this house, and the core value of the GOP. It is based on the political philosophy that our most important duty is to ensure that we can defeat any attempt by spending to take it over. In order to do that, we have to be present, and we need to have a remedy that stands to be able to cope with emergency when our economy needs adjustment. We have said there has been no greater need for a remedy that stands than in these uncertain times. And I agree. So that incidentally we heard of the IMF, who recently recommended to the EU that they should create a remedy that stands. Regrettably, in government that is not the idea of a remedy that stands, and proceeded to transfer all the green funds to the consolidated fund and spend the money. But the proposed transfer that I went and spoken to is simply the liberally run down between 1997 and 2010, which was a request of a charity community care. It has been otherwise, and added to what we have, are an area of exposure to the Brexit danger by not Mr. Bill, but there is nothing. And we have had to restart from zero in 2011. Mr. Clinton has also expressed approval of my commitment to keeping spending under control. But almost all the things they criticized are none of the things we did before 1996 in order to strengthen our economy, and they're also by the world criticizer for continuing to do things introduced by them between 1996 and 2011. I propose, therefore, Mr. Speaker, to do two things in my statement. Evaluate where we are in our last membership of the EU, and address a number of issues raised last year by the opposition to put the record straight. I will only evaluate the economic position for this year because I cannot evaluate where we are going to be next year after March, except that we will not be members of the EU any longer, that we have no idea what relationship, if any, the UK will then have with the EU, and that if there is one, whether it will be open to us to be a part of it, given Article 24, as the vision and indeed whether we would want to be a part of it. No serious economist would venture to forecast a direction in which our economy would or should develop in 2019, 20, or later years. The prudential thing to do in such circumstances always is prepare for the worst and aim for the best. We can and should look at this point as a transition of our economy, similar to the move from our descendants in the immediate expenditure in the 1980s. One thing is clear, that the size and the cost of the public sector, as it is expected at present, is not sustainable even without Brexit. There is a simple metric that we all need to understand, and we will be part of the public sector, so I include myself in what I have to say. Prior to 2011, the public sector was growing in number and cost. It has continued to do so since 2011, and the opposition has constantly criticized the growth, though in fact, it has been little different from what was happening when they were in office, and indeed, in the period 2011 to 2015, much of the increase which took place was a result of honoring their commitments and finishing the project started by them. Things, however, we have to change. Controlling officers have a duty to keep the department within budget. Ensuring that this is done is not my responsibility, since I am responsible for public sector efficiency. My job is to ensure that we work better, that is, more efficiently, in order to improve value for money and deliver improved services at the same or lower cost. Not keeping to budget is in conflict with the policy of the government to ensure greater efficiency. I know that within the public sector there are many who understand the need to move in this direction, but there are also those who do not. In order to understand why this is a problem that needs to be addressed, there are only two figures we need to know. On average, as we take that earnings, add 25% higher than your current equivalent, and 50% higher than the average earnings in the private sector. This year, this tax can be that. The gap between the lower state and the higher state in the public sector, and the average earnings gap between the public and the private sector. This is impossible to sustain economically and difficult to justify socially. The two main chances bring the state workers in this year to address this issue. In order to understand the problem, we need to realize that in spite of the growth in the level of the private sector employment prior to 2011 and since, the earnings gap has increased every year. This means that the growth needed in the private sector to provide government revenue to meet the increasing cost of the public sector gets bigger every year. It is for this reason that it is unsustainable in economic terms. With the uncertainty we face as for next year, it is an issue that can no longer be ignored. We have a duty to try and put the growth under the balance of relationship between the public and the private sectors of the economy. It is a matter for the world that Mr. Putin, who claims to be committed to a policy of living with our enemies, Russia accused us of creating austerity measures across the public sector under the guise of public sector efficiency. It seems a need to act to a little sense of understand where the public sector efficiency starts with the manner of responsibility for it. We are seeking to increase the level of efficiency in the public sector by looking at working methods and the introduction of a government that increases output without increasing manpower. The opposition accuses Russia of overspending and of austerity, both at the same time. Well, the public efficiency measures will ensure that we are able to maintain our public sector and avoid austerity. Because austerity is not another choice. Austerity happens the day when you do not have the money to do the things you want or need to do. It is to avoid finding ourselves in that situation that we have to examine how we deliver services and how we can improve what we do. The objective of the Ministry for Economic Development is to improve efficiency so that the very never arrives. There are things that we do in the public sector which have not changed since you and I have been in the house. In the budget of 1988, the first question the government answered was from you as leader of the opposition. And the answer was given by the Financial and Development Secretary, as was the norm in those days. The thing went as follows. You asked, what was the total sum broken by the government when considering the draft estimate for 1889, as announced on the 30th of March, in respect of the departmental bill, over and above the treasury allocation of recurrent expenditure and B in respect of terms of item spent as special expenditure. The financial secretary answered, Mr. Speaker, the government was unable in the time available between collection traffic and the latest date for circulation of the estimates to the House to give full consideration to the details of the departmental activity. It was therefore decided to accept for the purpose of appropriation bill with some exceptions related primarily to the policies of the new government, the Treasury estimates of the departmental requirements in accordance with the formula adopted in recent years. The departmental ministers will, however, give further consideration to the departmental bill for addition to this estimate, and a supplementary appropriation will be sought in due course in the right of it. It will not be normal practice for the government to reveal the departmental bids for increases in public expenditure when these have not been approved by ministers. However, in the 22nd century of this year, appropriation bill, when the bills were prepared during the previous government's tenure of office, or you were in government, as you think of it, it is prepared exceptionally to do so. The figures are for the current expenditure, £3.1 million, including £872,000 in respect of the Department of Authority. A special expenditure of £500,000, including £96,000 in respect of the Department of Authority. To have approved this bill in the light of the 2020 estimate, we have implied a deficit of £5.4 million for this year. The government is not prepared to contemplate a deficit of this magnitude and will seek to contain public spending within reach terms of the appropriation thing, when the government carries some public spending, is still there. Well, this is an example of something that happens every year. When hundreds of dollars are spent by the government and produce and use of things that would like to spend money on. Now, what is the credit? Members of the opposition who are doing government would know what I am talking about. This is done without reference to what is likely to be affordable given the previous year's revenue, which is known to everyone. Then, many more members have been discussing this request and removing many of them. It is a thing that has been done. And this is often the only explanation as to why things are still being done in many areas. We need to look at the detail of the workflow to see if things can be done differently. It is about working smarter, not about working harder. People can work very hard and produce very little value with no sense of their own. I recently participated in the Diagonal Forum for Commonwealth Manifesto of Telecommunication and IT in London. The Commonwealth countries represented by the Minister for Telecommunications went to Paris from India with 1.2 billion citizens to Tuvalu with 11,000. In all cases, governments were grappling with the issue of the transformation and changes of the use of technology in the public sector and the implications of artificial intelligence and the Internet of Things for the delivery of services. In the same by most of the magic and those brought about by the Industrial Revolution, working developer over the years has spent less than the money bringing experts in order to provide and extend the delivery of services instead of manual systems. But today we seem to have precious little to show for such investments. I come away from the conference with a feeling that we run the risk of being left behind, and that is the next thing we want to be doing at this point in time in our history. In addition to working methods, the efficiency drive route are mainly for pure supplies and other areas for possible savings. In the last 2 years, we have concentrated on the DHL simply because it was the biggest budget, working together with the Minister for Health and the Senior Management Team. The result can now be seen reflected in this year's DHL budget, which is close to what it was 2 years ago. Mr. Peter Garcia and a number of years expressed the concerns of the opposition and the growth in the size of the DHL budget since 2012. To put the situation in context, let me remind honorable members opposite of the historic rate of increase of the DHL budget. In 1998, we inherited a budget of 10 million from the AHR administration. The budget of the government increased that budget to 20 million by 1996, 2.5 times the original figure. Under the DHL, the DHL budget grew from 20 million to 80 million by 2012. That's not the original figure. Since 2012, it has grown further from 80 million to 120 million, a 50% increase. Let me make clear that by making this comparison, I am not for one moment suggesting that there are any grounds for complacency. There is a long road ahead before we get to where we should be across the public sector as a whole. But there has been done so far in the DHL shows that it is possible to exercise better control of spending. Last year, the Honorable Mr. Peter went into an analysis to justify his extraordinary decision of leader of the opposition to vote against the appropriation bill, which provided the estimate of expenditure for 2017-18. So I'm very glad to be successful in upholding that example. But the system is very divisive this year. It is something that no opposition has ever done before in debate's history. So I would think that it would take something unique to make it happen in 2017, to explain how this policy shift on the part of the GSP has come about, because there was only the four GSP members present to vote against. Mr. Peter was so sure of what he was doing that he told us that history would judge his decision, and that their speeches were going to be there as a matter of public record. Shortly after this, the resigned leader of the DSP and the opposition appointed the Honorable Mr. Clinton, acting in their capacity, pending an election within the DSP, eventually appointed an Roman Nathan member of his own successful family, a family who had previously left the DMV because he had drained. In the process, Graham against his own trade was candidate the Honorable Mr. Houston. I must say the Honorable Member feels that history has already judged what he did and punished him now for his mistake, or that it's been a final judgment to him in the future. And the public record of the speech of the day is the head of a policy of voting against the annual expenditure, which is promised to pay for the full service and all the other expenses that enable the government to provide services for our country. However, given that the annual medical service has an entire position of voting against the appropriation bill, and for the sake of the public record that Mr. Peter has set history to judge this episode by in future, I feel I have to say that it's finding myself here are utter and complete nonsense. Mr. Clinton, when he spoke after him, echoed the sentiment expressed by his brother's current Mr. Peter, implying that he was not the instigator of the policy, but was following the lead of his party and opposition leader. However, he can say that, and stated that he would not have had less of a estimate of expenditure or indeed any other appropriation bill presented by us, which in his judgment did not have the necessary facts and figures to arrive at an informed decision. This, in fact, means that for as long as this position remains the view of the GST, they will be voting against the law. Incidentally, the facts and figures from last year were also the same as the ones provided between 2012 and 2015 when we voted in favor of the appropriation bill. There were also the same as the GST appropriation bills between 1996 and 2011. The same as the GSSB between 1988 and 1996. And the same as the NUCR between 1972 and 1987. So what was so special about the last year? Neither Mr. Peter nor Mr. Clinton thought to explain what was different about the year's appropriation bill to make them vote again. I will in due course and for a record show that their analysis was wrong in a number of areas mentioned, especially that of Mr. Peter. But at this stage, let me point out something that would have been blindingly obvious to the two members. What Mr. Clinton implied that he was that he believed the information contained in the book of recurrent expenditure was that the tip of the iceberg of government spending, and that the bulk of recurrent spending was not contained in the appropriation bill. This information was what they required should be shown, and that unless they were shown the rest of the iceberg, they would not vote for it. Well, even if they had been correct in their approach of potential, which they were not, there is no logic in their argument. The appropriation bill is the approval by Parliament for the withdrawal of money from the consolidated fund. The vote is to provide this approval without which no one can defend, including the honorable members themselves, who voted against if the opposition salary comes from that kind of setting. So they do not vote for the bill after vote, for which full details are being provided, as they have been in the same form in every previous appropriation bill since 1972. Because right now, when you agree that there is a far bigger level of expenditure, that was going to be spent in the last 4 months by the government without them being asked to vote for it and without them being given an explanation for it. So the explanation that they had was for the right to vote. Even if this organization had been correct, which is lesson and teaching, they had nothing to do with matter. And I would say, why, Mr. Speaker? It is the withdrawal of money from the consolidated fund that has to be approved. That is what this argument, the head of the country before, and the legislative council before, was still had to be approved. With the Clinton's concept of channeling government company revenues and expenditure through the consolidated fund, which would then require a vote for the money to be spent by the company, is something that makes no sense whatsoever. It has never been put forward as a GST objective in any election. It is contrary to the way every previous government has ever been dealt with a running a state owned company in the 15 years of the GST administration, the 8 years of the GSLP before that, parents ready and extended to Indiana and Pennsylvania to pursue the Glansburg. Nevada left the Duke of Glansburg in his search for the expenditure about to be incurred in 1718. The Duke of Glansburg did that in order to be just 10% of the loss of the home. So he was telling that, but he was refusing to withdraw 490 million from the 78% over a financial year to pay for recurring government debt because the government intended to take an additional 4.41 billion to have brought 90% of the debt and retire its spending in 78%. The fact that they all agree that it might have been exaggerated a little bit when the first was going to be a policy. Certainly, you are exaggerating the other reason concurrent expenditure when compared to the estimate by the institution. Already, this is to be the very expenditure of the picture, not something that kept the picture of what the government has directly and directly spent. When actually, we are supposed to be voting on what we are planning to spend and not on the forecast factor of the previous year, which is very possible interpretation of the use of the past tense. So we seem to be saying that in the year 1617, the forecast item of 470 million was only half of the recurrent expenditure that we had incurred in that year, which according to him would have amounted to another 475 million pounds, not from the estimate and not funded from the consolidated fund. So, it's a different variation of this that is the argument, was for not voting. Was that in 1960 and 1970, we had spent an amount equal to the funding of the whole recurrent expenditure of the government, an additional 475 million pounds sent to companies that year which were not in the estimate. Which, of course, is utter and complete nonsense and pure invention on its part. And incidentally, the next team will enter with other arguments of here to explain the system to vote against the appropriation bill. It is financial and the following. The very simple reason for that, meaning that the expenditure in the book, so only half of it had been spent in 2016-2017, is that the government borrowed 772 million pounds. They will repeat that, he said. 772 million pounds that we know of the government and the control company, which we have used and continue to use to fund the expenditure, and none of that is reflected in this book we are debating today. Well, whatever it is that the Bureau of Bolivia said was debating in the course of the appropriation bill, it clearly was not the appropriation bill to the head of the book. Moreover, he was obviously not talking about the estimate for 1718. He was only arguing about the estimate for 1617. That he had voted in favor of the previous year. Because he had done the most of the argument to the forecast action surplus of 75.8 million for 2016-2017. This, which is what the chief minister has said, perfectly, was the result of the current 172 million, we were told. The 75.8 was a result of the 772 million. I would remind them that we were talking about recurrent revenue and recurrent expenditure, and that the 75.8 million pounds for 2016-2017 was the excess of revenue over recurrent expenditure. Recurrent revenue over recurrent expenditure. So, we're talking about borrowing. I think borrowing was annually recurring revenue to meet annually recurring expenditure in order to create a surplus. If anyone in this house has ever demonstrated that they didn't have a clue what you're talking about, no one of them has clearly and exclusively or as well as Mr. Stephen Bilbao. And you would be aware, Mr. Speaker. Even others, but of course, if the debt in the government owned company to the tune of 772 million, that sort of money is being used to pay for expenditure that is properly government expenditure, and that expenditure is not reflected in this account, it is not possible to say that the government is running the public finances of the Volta at a surplus of revenue over expenditure.
said that the sooner they get into the gap where they will have made them to face an 8 million pound surplus balance during the preceding year, 2016 2017, because they believe that companies, government companies, have borrowed 772 million pounds. And this added for spending that could have been included on the expenditure side of the forecast as the proposition said. And I think, let me explain to your honorable member, Cable Beck, show the difference he cannot explain by looking at the book. And then it doesn't happen then as well as explanation. The 2016-2017 appropriation bill, which we voted for, estimated revenue at 590.8 million pounds and expenditure at 517.5 million pounds and projected a surplus of 20.3 million. The forecast outcome that he was referring to earlier was for a surplus which he was quoting at 75.8 million, that is 55.5 million more than anticipated at the time the appropriation bill was approved by him in 2016. He told us this bill, but it was actually not true, because there were 772 million pounds borrowed by companies which had taken upon expenditure that should have been in the book. So, if the only recorded expenditure from the approved instrument was not the reason for the increased surplus, as I said, what was it? Well, the answer was already known in the book. Expenditure was actually unbudgeted at 578 million instead of 570.5 million. But the revenue came higher by a much bigger margin of 653.8 million instead of 590.8 million. So the increased revenue of 53 million, less the increased expenditure of the 7.5 million, increased by 53.5 the estimated surplus in the 2016-2017 appropriation bill of 22.3 million to the forecast level of 75.3, a difference of 55.5. Simple. And in the book. In fact, not only all in the book, the Honourable Mr. Winter knew it was all in the book. And that's the simple issue. When we refer to the reason for the surplus of the 75.8 million, he said, I quote, the government surplus, longer than expected, was entirely due to revenue being 63 million pounds greater than expected. Entirely due to this, not due to the 4.772 million pounds of oil water in debt, none of the sales of beauty and property schemes in any particular deal, nor investments made by the Swedish bank in order to be able to pay a positive rate of interest that the bank sends to customers. Not this figure. Entirely due to the economy. The analysis by the Honorable Mr. Peter Mathias was about the 2016-17 focus circle, and what did he actually find in 2016 when he voted in favor of the appropriation? The tone of his objection was so different that it is difficult to believe we are talking about the situation. He told us that we face potentially the single largest threat to our economic model since the frontier frontier, and we view in the history of the democratic government in the Russia. As a result, he said it was important that the debate take place within a framework of sober analysis, prudent and realism. He said, in spite of the criticism of our 4 years of government spending, it was his duty to steer a careful line between all the citizens and the need to maintain confidence and work with the government to steer the voter into calmer water. He added, to do our work would constitute a dereliction of duty. And it is not for our important work. It is therefore a difficult speech that I do not have to make, balancing as I must objective interaction of the state of our public finances, which is my principal duty at the moment to look at, against a very difficult factor indeed. I asked myself, Mr. Speaker, what was the question 2 years later to make him abandon the balance of the need not to remain confident in the voter, but for the first time ever in our history, vote against the appropriation of funds from the conformity to come to an equal balance to continue functioning up to July 17. Basically, all the allies having a modern ability and a successful in Nova Provincia, on the 1st of August, nobody would ever have a choice. I want to ask that. The arguments in the Constitution of 17 brought them and brought what had been used in previous times, in previous budgets, with the same arguments, are not the answer. There is nothing new in the Constitution of 17. Nothing new in the Constitution of 2016. Indeed, in everything it has got worse, with Article 24 veto granted to Spain and the failure of the EU to respond to any of the compromises and ideas of Eastern Ukraine. We are now much closer to a quick edge departure than we went in 2016 since the date the position has not improved. So, what was the reduction of expenditure in 1617 from the 772 million, which the honorable member had in mind, which brought the group to vote again? He told us not yet. He said, today the government comes to this house and says in as much as 75.7, he made a mistake because of the hybrid base for that. It is complete nonsense when it is not accounting for expenses in government and companies. It's simple, but the lowering value of the system is that through government and companies, the government is paying the commuted expenses of civil servants. That is traditional government expenditure, and the expenditure no longer appears in this book. It is paid through government owned or controlled companies. I interjected from the 7th grade of system, which I know is not allowed, which is a very good idea. That was my intervention. Mr. Peter responded, I hear the following by saying, it's a very good idea. When Mr. Speaker, when they have been at this school, this is why I spoke along the street and to put the record straight and demonstrate how confused the honorable member was at some of this feeling. I was not saying it was a very good idea, Mr. Speaker. I was not saying that since the idea was mine. But I can tell the fact that I haven't been told by some 145 people that it was a brilliant idea. Do what I did now. All I was thinking of doing was quoting someone else that had said in the previous budget the work that I told. The question in the budget of 2016, the committed pension of civil service has traditionally been an expense of the government, and now it's an expense of Credit Finance Company Limited. The effect, it does not take a drop of time to spend work this time, is that, of course, the government does not have to pay that money directly paid to the for the commuted pension of civil service, which is a jolly good idea, Mr. Speaker, and I'm not criticizing it. Do you remember, Mr. Speaker, who said it's a jolly good idea and I'm not criticizing it? Wait for it. It was the Honorable Mr. Peter, who clearly had forgotten a year later when he had said in 2016. Thankfully, my own memory seems to have been slightly better than that. And I can remember things that I said a year ago and indeed many years before. It is obvious that the overall member is not a rocket scientist. And a jolly good thing too, otherwise we would have lots of rockets exploding all over the place. He was not criticizing me in 2016. He just wanted to explain. Okay, I have done this before, but I will explain it again. And this is the story you remember. When the DSB decided to allow private sector employees to commute 100% of their pensions on retirement, I asked from the opposition, I asked for the same to be done for civil service pensioners. The venture minister, the great people told me on our time, did not reject the idea in principle, but it could not be financed. Well, I have thought of a way of financing it, and we committed ourselves to doing it in the 2011 general election. It is what I call a reverse annuity. In the funded benefit scheme, what you do is you accumulate a sum of money which matures when you retire. This money is available to buy an annuity, which is eventually the government on one stage announced who would be colliding with him in the Volta Saving Plan, which I would never criticize him for, but which they never put into practice. The reality is the income paid to the pensioner purchased by the long term to save from the pension fund. What we provide is the opposite, but with a similar mechanism. The civil servant retirement gets paid by the government, the pension, monthly, and then uses this income to buy a long term, the commutation, by entering into an agreement with the department. This was the legal of civil servants only. And in 2012, the then honorable leader of the opposition approached me to ask whether it was going to be extended to members of this house and if he was interested in the facility. I told him I was trying to find a way of extending it, as the older person to honor would not be able to enjoy the opportunity of 100% commutation would be members of the house. Now that both public and private employees are able to do it. Although originally in National Foundation, when I explained the mechanism in the house, it's not the logic of how the system works. So let's be clear, credit finance does not pay as a benefit government pensions. Government pensions continue to be a direct tax on the consolidated fund as provided by law and does not require members to vote the fund in the appropriation bill. So nothing has been removed from the voting of the appropriation bill, and therefore it is not necessary. I am not voting because there is nothing recurrent expenditure which is essentially no longer paid by the government and now paid by credit finance in order to reduce the size of the expenditure of the government. This is not the case now and has never been the case any time since 2011. The cost to the government of paying sales to the expenditure has grown, but is not included in the amount we are voting this year, on the amount we are voting in every year since 1973, when you and I, Mr. Speaker, voted in our first budget. The cost of pensions from the consolidated fund was put by the GOP government at £19.6 million in 2010-11. It was estimated to grow to £20 million by the last budget for 2011-12. And the outcome worth 21.5 million, an increase of 1.9 million over the preceding year. It was estimated to cost 36.5 million last year, when the honorable member voted against the appropriation bill, and the item is now 37 million. The estimate for the current year is 40 million pounds. So, Mr. Speaker, from the last budget of the GSP in 2011-12, to the budget of the current year 2018-19, the cost of the government, which Mr. Peter says was no longer paying the pension, paid by the government, had grown 100%. And is now put at 40 million instead of 20 million a year. This is a 100% increase over the last 7 years compared with the slower increase in the last 7 years of the GSB administration on the in 2004-2005 for a consolidated pension payment was 11.5 million and grew to 20 million in 2011-12, an increase of 74% or 74%. The cost of the government of paying pensions has in fact grown faster than the fundamental expenditure that it voted on and included in the appropriation bill, which is increased from an estimate of 316.6 million pounds in the last budget of 2011-12 to 512.3 million pounds for 1890, an increase of 61.8%. Indeed, I predict that the cost of pensions will continue to grow at a faster rate than the recurrent operating cost of the government, since this is something we have to control and to some extent are already doing. That is, we are taking steps to contain the latter, but there's nothing we can do about the former. When the question of credit finance and the payment of pension, I will deal also with the argument on the size of the non-government debt, the eye-watering non-government debt, Mr. Speaker. Let me just remind Member Hockerty that I do not need any lessons from them on sound and prudential approach to debt or public spending. I would refer members to the first budget of the GPP in 1988, which I referred to earlier in the context of question number one of 1988 from yourself, Mr. Speaker. known by the speech has been delivered by the Financial and Development Secretary as has been the case in every case since I was elected in 1972. The Constitution of 1969 mentioned by mandatory that it would move the appropriation bill, which is now done by the Minister of Finance. The challenge by the 2006 Constitution was claimed by the GSP in the 2007 budget to be evident for the renowned decolonized. On that way, the Kennedys were at the top to decolonize in 1988. Because this time, the Financial and Development Secretary made a mass protest speech in the first piece of everybody, the 1 minute statement, starting with the word, I propose to make a very short introductory statement, and then with the word, the only thing I need to say, Mr. Speaker, is that having said most of my period of Financial Secretary restraining public expenditure was very successful. Of course, it is not only an honor for me to work on appropriation bill, which comes as closely to truthful purity as it is possible for me to imagine our first budget. But I have great pleasure as well in commending the bill to the House, having made a point, Mr. Speaker, that duty will not give way to a history, as already mentioned by the Chief Minister. My duty is not here, but the history is here. The Honourable Graham and Taylor, the Honourable Graham and Taylor, with whom I have crossed from the opposition benches on many occasions, had a sense of humour and is defender of the Queen. In 1988, my contribution concentrated on making clear that we would tackle deficits but not borrow to cover them, which has been happening in the past. I said, we do not believe in borrowing for the current expenditure, and therefore it will be our intention to use the players in the laws and power in ordinance, which is a program for investment, and not to fund recurrent expenditure. A policy, which I'm glad to say, was also followed by the US government, after 1992. However, it is also a point to note that the state and companies in existence then were never included in the government estimates during the GSP government or subsequent years of the GSP government. Incidentally, as has been previously stated, it was the GSP who introduced borrowing by companies as an alternative to government debt. It was done initially for the purchase and conversion of the Eurofund building, and in reply to my question to the then Chief Minister, he said that although there was a slight and higher rate of interest, it was not sovereign debt, but the debt secured on the value of the asset. The same counter was then used in the construction of copper, which was removed from the island this time, and where the revenue from the copper were expected to service the line, but in the end it was found not to be sufficient. The GSP in 2011, when the Honourable Minister Peter was in government, had entered into an arrangement to raise a company loan for the proposed Papa's Rock generating station, because there was to be a roadshow in the state to raise the money and a commitment of 5% annual increase in electricity charges to create profit from the sale of electricity to service the loan. All of that was in the book. What about the performance of the economy? The Honourable Mr. Peter Martin said that I was right to be cautious about the size of the future GDP. In 2007, when the Honourable Member joined the GDP government, I predicted that the GDP for 2008 would be £800 million. The view of the GDP government expressing that budget by the greatest humanitarian of our time was not very shocking. Rather than reply to my analysis of the state of the economy in that budget, the reaction was to tell me that my question about the figure did nothing for my credibility and even less for my willing reputation of the supposed authority. Well, we all know that in politics you cannot please everybody. I was then predicting an £800 million return for 2008 GDP. 3 years later, the GDP published the 2008 GDP, and it was $806 million. So I underestimated the figure. I also predicted the 2012 return at $1.2 billion, and the final figure came in at $1.201. So I underestimated again, this time by $1 billion. Based on the $1.2 billion, I predicted the result for 2016 of $1.8 billion. This year, we have the 2020, were 3.4 billion pounds, a 600 million pound increase in output over the 4 years. The projected estimate for 2018 is estimated at 2.18, a 396 million pounds increase in 2 years. This figure can go down as more results are inputted and estimates replaced. But if it stays at this level, then there is a very good chance that we will meet our target or even slightly surpass it. I have more questions. Your colleague of mine is right. One element of GDP growth is the growth in the payroll of the labor force. In the case of the construction industry, this is the payroll of construction workers. In turn, this is the best indication of how much of the growth of the economy is due to construction projects, and can be deduced by comparing in different periods of time the number of construction workers. I have explained this before to Mr. Peter and members of the opposition, but we have nothing of memory, and they nonetheless insist on the basis of personal intuition that the growth in the economy is fueled by government construction projects financed by the eye watering $772 million, this mysterious $772 million, which appears in almost every budget with the figure changing every time on the way up. I will provide the honorable member with the construction figures again to get his memory on update the information in the light of the 2017 employment survey report tabled in the House, which shows the latest estimate. I have previously compared the private sector labor market on different dates to establish the relative importance of the construction sector, showing how it played a bigger role before 2011. This looked at the position in 2007, 2011, and 2015, which I remind members of now, and add an update by including 2005, that is going back to 30 years, and 2017, so that we look at where we are today. The changes over 6 years instead of 4. The number of private sector jobs at the start of the previous period, 2007, excluding the construction industry, amounted to 13,340. In the 4 years to 2011, it grew to 14,038, an increase of 698 jobs, representing a 5.2% expansion of private sector job market outside construction. The growth in the GDP was 49% in the same period. So it is quite evident that the private sector in non-construction expansion can only have accounted for a small share of the growth. The growth was 49%, the non-construction growth was 5.2%. That cannot have been responsible. The construction sector, however, increased by 701 jobs, more than the growth of the whole of the private sector together, an increase of 31.5%, evidently the main engine of the increase. This is what we have to give these. In the 4 years from 2011, by comparison, the figures show the opposite. The GDP grew again by 39.1%, and the private sector, excluding construction, increased its size to provide 2,926 jobs. Employees in the non-construction sector went up from 14,038 to 16,964, 20.8% higher. The contrast that was happening in the construction industry could not be greater. The exchange of the construction sector from 2011 to 2015 was 150, 190, I beg your pardon, amounting to a 6% increase in the workforce. The evidence is clear. The growth between 2007 and 2011 was much, much more dependent on public sector capital program construction boom than has been the case in the period 2011 to 2015. In 2015, non-construction private sector jobs have gone by almost 2,000, non-construction, 2,000, bringing the total in 2011 to 5,925. By contrast, the private sector workforce in the same period born by the mere 144. So they commanded the mountains of the opposition, as the Prime Minister Putin last year, as leader of the opposition, was that the economy had grown in 1 year from 1.75 billion to 1.91 billion, he didn't question the figure, an increase of 160 million, and that this 160 million was to a large extent due to the government injecting hundreds of millions of pounds to produce significant economic growth. Hundreds of millions of pounds of government money plus private sector investment to provide 160 million growth. Not what it says, or at all. Of course, not the economic side. But yet, hundreds of millions of pounds being injected into the construction industry. In the construction industry, they are saying that they create less workers in 1517 than in 1516. So, there are hundreds of millions of jobs injected into that year. Maybe you are aware of that, but you need to apply this analysis to your own year. So, let's look at what happened to the economic government. Did 134 more construction workers in 2017 than in 2011 produce the bulk of 6 year growth and not the 4,925 workers in the other industry? I will say it in this because to the real individual, anybody in the voter was born to the real individual themselves. It seems to me that for an equity that they decided a long time ago that the only way the economy could grow was on the back of a construction boom. Because it was what was happening between 2007 and 2011, the only thing that Mr. Peter was in government. And therefore, they came to the conclusion that this is what must have also been happening since 2011, irrespective of the evidence to the contrary. Let me have one further comparison. Given the changes in the composition of the private sector workers in 6 years, 2011 to 2017. Construction workers 144. The rest of the private sector 4,925. Let's look at the 6 years 2005 to 2011. The increase in the period under the GDP was construction workers 1,321. Not 144. 1,321 in the construction. The rest of the private sector 2,827. Mr. Speaker, the data speaks for themselves. And Mr. Speaker, and Mr. Speaker, they are welcome to the vote of Stevens Bank. The same, using the same arguments that we used before 2015. They seem to forget that the policy of the government and the role of the Stevens Bank was defended in the general election and sent by the election manifesto. What is it we are doing with the Savings Bank as we promised we would do and receive a mandate from the electorate to implement? This is to grow the size of the Savings Bank with a target to increase deposits to achieve a deposit base of 1.6 billion by 2019-2020, up from 1.1 billion that we expected to have reached in 2015-2016. In 2015-2016, we actually fell out of the target with 990 million pounds in deposits, which added to the reserve came to a total of 1,060 million pounds. Since then, we have had a massive increase in deposits from the public, both new and existing customers, and deposits recently stood at 1.35 billion. 360 million since 1516. I'm sure members of opposition must be horrified to hear that the devoted savings bank is doing so well, especially the honorable Mr. Beaton, who told us last year the saving mark of the country. It was really felt as the eye watering debt of 792 million. That he knew of. Which, when added to the government debt of 447 billion, produced an even more eye-watering debt of 1.2 billion. A gross debt of that figure, he said, was running at 62.5% of GDP. Well, I will deal with his book publication shortly, but let me just remind the House that the percentage of gross that to do the case, their men are not any meaning of relevance because he, in government, removed the legal link between God's death and GDP. So let's see what he said about the world. He told us that the Swedish bank in 2011 had £27.6 million of debentures and bonds for the public. He said, in other words, money borrowed by the Devoted Savings Bank from members of the public, owed to members of the public, was £27.6 million. The total of debentures and bonds issued by the Devoted Savings Bank at the 31st of March 2017 was £834.5 million. That represents an increase, Mr. Speaker, of 3,023% in 6 years. Actually, we're quoting the wrong figure. The Savings Bank is better on this, but worse in the water rise of the opposition. The figure for the ventures and bonds in the investors' book was 902.3 million, a 3,621% increase. And the similar figure for March 17 was 921.9 million increase, a magnificent, that is, the profit and water level, an eye-watery 3,340% increase, expected this year to reach over 1 billion, an incredible 3,623% increase. And I'm looking at this even better, or worse in the eyes of the members of the state in the next financial year. This is not a sovereign fund. Well, of course, it is not a sovereign fund. But describing it as a debt to the public is a strange way of describing what a savings bank or any other bank does. I never described it like that when I was in government. To be honest, the reason for the huge increase is that the government embarked on a process when they got elected of shifting the debentures issued by government directly, which legally counts as public debt, to the GSB, where it does not count as a debt of the government. It is a debt owed by the Devoted Savings Bank to the members of the public. Let's look at the reasonable number says that this £800 million increase is because we took government debt and put it in the savings bank, and therefore the government debt went down 800. But based on the figures and the language that is using, he is saying that the growth from 27 million to 834 million was primarily by a drop of government debentures and the replacement by the Devoted Savings Bank bonds and debentures. This was not totally false. In the first place, there was no 807 million of government debentures to put to a savings bank. Secondly, in December, there was 280 million in government debentures, which is 318 million in March 12. Thirdly, the debentures were repaid to the members of the public who invested some of their cash in savings bank debentures, around 250 million. And thirdly, the savings bank in turn purchased 250 million pounds of the better government debentures after the public debt. So the public debt was the same. The result of the fact was that the level of government debt was reduced by £68 million that the public took in cash, and that the public debt is still composed of the £250 million of the debenture that the savings bank debt, and it's the same as it was before the construction took place. And the first is the £200 million from the bank. So this is what I cannot understand. The members of the think that it is a very bad thing for the government to borrow from its own bank and give it the benefit of the interest paid, but fine to do so from our bank and give them the benefit. These are the policy of the government today, and the Devoted Savings Bank is the policy of the GSP government of 1988 of the Devoted Savings Bank. The GSP increased the role of the savings bank in 1988 and developed it so that by 1996, we had £165.9 million instead of £2.7 million in 1988. It says, I go about a few minutes. An even more terrible percentage increase of 6,144, which the GSP at the time did not control. The benefit suffering from water, the only place would be a good one. The savings bank role has incorrectly identified by the honorable member, Mr. Clinton, previously, describing it as fulfilling the function of a development bank. It did so between 1988 and 1996, and continues to do so since 2011. In between, the DSA ran the bank down to Russia. If the relevant bank into government, they will do the same again, given the remarks of Mr. Peter McGregor, the position and leader of the DSA in 2017 and several years. So when has anybody described a bank as having debt because it accepts the purpose of the public? The only reason for doing so is to make it sound negative. Banks accept to keep saving for the public and to invest the money as a profit. This works with the business consisted of a little something different than Mr. Clinton was running in bank. The government is proud of the role of a savings bank in providing us a clear for the savings of our people and putting those savings to work for the economic growth for our country. Mr. Clinton took as if it was something bad that we're trying to buy, and that he had discovered something that the public did not know. Well, Mr. Speaker, he knows that as Minister for the Savings Bank, I produced a report containing this information for our customers, which could be that as the increases that are taking place in deposits every year. This is something that reflects the confidence that our customers have in the institution that they see as a safe home for their money. As we ask, Mr. Clinton, whether the bank that employed him as a director would have punished or rewarded him if that bank had increased deposits by over 2,000%. So now we know that no government debt was transferred from the government to the savings bank in order to reduce the government debt. The $437 million which was added to the $772 million to increase the overwatering of debt by combining it into a $1.2 billion can now be discarded. The government debt of $437 million is the reduced level of government debt from the GST debt of $520 million in 2011. It is not money borrowed by us since 2011. What about the $772 million of non-government debt? The $400 million of self-owned debt is an investment in the shares of Credit Finance Company Limited. Credit Finance has a money lending license. Money lending companies lend money. People have to make a profit. For Arena. So, if Credit Finance lends money to the same bank as a commercial rent of interest, this is not a single non-government debt. It is the debt that the same bank company owns. If the loan was to be made to the Sandman Hotel that is built in Victoria Beck in London, it would not matter if the water lies on the opposition. Because all the investments in the loan in the UK and in the river bottles in the savings bank are okay as far as that is concerned. If Britain finance lends money to a former chief minister who pays interest and repays the loan by transferring to credit finance with entitlement to a final salary patron, and for the countless of other civil servants pensioners, it is not in order to reduce the expenditure of the appropriation bill, as has already been said, and it is not a hidden debt of the government, because the loan has not been made to the government, but to individuals. If the savings bank debt is discredited, it is not a hidden government debt, it is a tax for the masses, just as it is bought shares in business telephone. Because the DSA tells Red to RBS, in his paper going to be rectified, which the GST has government already, this is not even government then. It is a perfectly reasonable and acceptable form of making the use of GST, which used to be GST in opposition, did not criticize when it was done. If they did the same as the fact of the construction of carpets, using the kind of carpet, it is not a hidden government then, but creating an asset that produces revenue. This is how the opposition has yet concocted the $772 million co-working hidden debt. This very said to me recurring government expenditure. And much of it was done before 2017, and some of it even before 2011. This even was used to justify the incomprehensible vote against the appropriation bill. Indeed, in the recent vote, which is even said no, another same 27,172 million. So the link could not be clear enough. In closing, I want to say that the Government for Employment, Apprenticeship and Vocational Training is working as intended, and the results reflect the increase in Yugoslavian employment. The October 2017 Yugoslavian employment level at 11,130 was 910 more than in October 2011. It compares with an increase of 350 between 2005 and 2011, the last 6 years of the GSP government. We have more emphasis in placing unemployment workers in the private sector of construction industry and elsewhere using the public contract requirement introduced in 2010 by the GSP, which I welcomed at the time. In the 2011 budget, the then Minister for Labour said there are many areas of employment which the private sector, in the private sector, which are not attractive enough to the local unemployed. As I have stated in the past, he said, few, if any, are clamoring to replace foreign labour in the private construction market, including in hotels, shops, bars, or restaurants. That's what Mr. Peter said. I have heard every time I see someone break down in front of me, as indeed they do, because I simply cannot find employment, any employment, anywhere, even if they're deciding to go there. Well, I am happy to look into any case of local unemployed persons, people I'm willing to work, and help in any way I can, if the Honourable Member provides me with information. Similarly, my doors continue to be open to any employer in any industry who is interested in taking on apprentices for which my department will provide financial support. And therefore, I repeat my call that they should approach me directly, since approaching Mr. Phillips does not enable us to engage, as he is unwilling to provide me with a contact. Finally, I am apologize, Mr. Speaker, for having to thank my contribution here, as I will be glad to run in this evening to officially open the magnificent new asbestos free Cancer Hall tomorrow morning. I will be back tomorrow evening, and as part of the house, I hope that members will be able to take one of the words. As patron of the Cancer Hall charity, I would like to thank members of the once again for their support, and especially the Honourable Mr. Fiedler for his initiative at the start of the fundraising campaign in coming forward to donate a salary of 1 month to the charity. Thank you. I accuse this government of failing to produce a meaningful budget and prudent assessment book for 2018-19. As a speaker, I accuse this government of failing to meet basic standards of transparency and accountability in public finance. And as a speaker, I accuse this minister of being the architect of this dismal state of affairs in respect to our public finances. And that's the biggest opportunity for you to do so as a minister attack to be a rhetoric. I intend to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, each of those are being true. I'm the speaker of Lula and Fort Region, our place, our duty is to speak out. I do not wish to be an accomplice in this kind of thing. End quote. I don't want to set off quite clearly in response to my notion in March earlier this year. And with the federal GOP policy, not to have the finance bill presented at budget time. And the result, Mr. Speaker, nothing, absolutely nothing, that the Chief Minister said today ever got any budgetary measures or tax changes has any practical legal effect when he sat down. If you need any proof of this, Mr. Speaker, you're going to look at the last number 4462 issued on the 24th of May 2019, in which it appears 3 years of budget measures were introduced in one go. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, we in the House today do not have the ability to debate or vote on those budget measures. I don't know if that's before, is the appropriation bill. Because when you had a proper finance bill, then we would allow for reasonable recess to enable the opposition to digest the measures and prepare a considered response. And then, Mr. Speaker, governments have no interest in scrutiny by the opposition, and gradually, there's not a great deal with this play about what is announced today. But it's been up to reply and make some observations of what we are heard today from the Chief Minister. Firstly, Mr. Speaker, hopefully, I'm not a smoker, nor am I a great drinker. So the budget increases in terms of taxation in these areas is not something I will necessarily regret. The other measures that have been introduced by the Chief Minister, particularly in respect of interview offer, were no doubt be welcomed by the Water Supply and Council by then, or already quite hard on this point. And anything that will continue, Mr. Speaker, to enable the operations of business in Gibraltar to be effective and efficient should be welcomed. I also think, Mr. Speaker, I'm a bit mystified by one of the governments in getting involved in the Dodgers Act and providing a saving for the product. And we just think I'd like to hear more on this from the Chief Minister as to what the rationale is for the saving bank to get involved. My concern is, Mr. Speaker, that where the better way to anything else in the UK or in Gibraltar, that will effectively be affecting the discount rate and are found to be corrupted, and have been effectively allowed and assured to give a lower payout. But again, Mr. Speaker, I welcome the Chief Minister's thought on this matter, and why there is a need for the Senate to be involved at all. And Mr. Speaker, we have put one positive for the ladies in the committee, and that is the abolition of duty on handouts. It might come up with some truth as well. And no doubt he will enlighten us as to the recap on the two articles.
10% increase can be 60 cents per hour. This is something I would welcome more clarity on by the Chief Minister. Well, the comment to hear from the Chief Minister is about the 10% social insurance increase across the board. Now, if you think that I did criticize the Chief Minister last year for not having mentioned this during budget time, and of course this year I do indeed welcome the health announcement as part of the budget. But the figure, the 10% increase in social insurance, if we are after doing so well, and supposedly we know that it's working last year, when we were in the Opposition Convention in 2010, we said, of course, if we are running these surpluses, if we are such good friends, how well would it be then we need to probably increase the cost of doing business in diversity? Which indeed he is. If you think of last year, when it has the increases in March, from September, March 2017, the 10% increases we have effectively cost employers on average an extra £183.56 per annum per employee. An employee took home £151.58 less on average. Those were last year's measures. This year, another 20% increase. What we would see to see that is that the employer will be having to pay an extra £189.80 for an employee. An employee will be worth £543 on average each. This is not really embedded in the working family. The business of people is really perhaps the government commonly predicted in Brexit budget. But if you don't want to say, oh, this is a Brexit budget, now you are on the boat, it's going to be so good. Because it's in just state. Mr. Speaker, as I said, if we have more time, we will have a more detailed analysis on this budget. But then, to be honest, Mr. Speaker, there isn't much to analyze in the budget. There are not much in the way of measures. The only measure that I can welcome is the capping of speculative profits on affordable housing, which I think we can all agree is something we would not wish to encourage. Although the absence of a process bill, the government has also slipped into the bad habit of taking the supplementary appropriation bill for passing well after the budget debate. Not only is it logical, Mr. Speaker, but it also has the effect of denying the peaceful auditor's report, which has still got passed in respect of 2015. Mr. Speaker, if I may remind the House, is what the Chief Minister said on the 2nd of March 2016. My friend, before the Medical Appropriation Bill for the year are ready now debated in this House of around June or July of each year as part of the budget session, this is meant that the annual audit accounts for the previous year are necessarily being delayed. I'm sorry to rule of these supplementary appropriations. The people also have not been able to complete his audit of the annual public accounts until then. In order to enable the people to complete the audit of the annual audit of the accounts, however, the people have those accounts been able to have on a more timely basis, the government has decided to reverse the legal practice of presenting the supplementary appropriation bill separately. Mr. Speaker, the supplementary appropriation bill for 2014 and 2015
was published on the 17th of December 2015, and the date of empowerment on the 2nd of March 16. The document in the publication bill for 15 years of extension was published on the 22nd of December 2016, and the figure left the date of empowerment until the 6th of December 2017, over 3 years later. The Population Preservation Bill for 1617 was published on the 12th of January 2018, and then left to debate it in this House. The government, Mr. Speaker, which is a very little for the budgetary process and biological scrutiny, are merely a few major forces of delay the public function of the people ordering the report, as much as possible, because, Mr. Speaker, budgets are to be used for everything. Mr. Speaker, to take me to the President's book and the Preservation Bill itself. I think the most thinking do today is regard those types of areas. I'm going to make a general trend, which is worthy of comment, and the fact that I've been picked up by the Chamber of Commerce in their annual report. It's a particular current revenue. $655.7 million in March 2017. And we now see the upswing to March 2018 to the area of $635 million. And yet, recurrent expenditure as a proportion of revenue, or the other way, as a proportion of revenue, is growing from 88% in 2017 to 94%. In 2018, which is the biggest figure for 2019 to 96%. As this will, the federal tax will be honorable to the very high, quite rightly pointed out, this is just not sustainable. It's a bit of a growing trend that will not allow for much of a buffer should government revenue suffer a downturn next year because of Brexit or any other reason. And it's a bit of in those percentages, I have included the $25 million that is appropriated to finance government companies and which the government include in the preparation of what they call a surplus. But we're about to make that, Mr. Speaker. This is a increases in fees from articles of currency, business licenses, fines, bed licenses, general parking permits, housing rentals. We see an average recorded 15% increase in rents across the board for residential dwellings. Very taxing, Mr. Speaker. A concern, Mr. Speaker, and really concern, is a potential decrease in the cash reserve of the government from $127.6 million in 2017 to $96.1 million in 2019. There will then be a consequential increase in net debt in 2019 to $339.9 million, which is well from the government's manifesto target of $300 million net debt by 2020. Indeed, this is a bit surprising, but in the last time, $410 million in 2019, the general speaker there, as at the 28th of February 2018, they had $260.4 million deposited in the bank, of which I think that the figure includes guaranteed company cash. And then, to take a further estimate, and it's fair, as of the 31st of March 2018, they were expecting to be only $164.6 million. I mean, I would be grateful that the figure for its funding were $95.8 million as reported in just 1 month. The figure is currently that from a balance of $308 million on the 31st of March 2017, it is anticipated that by the 31st of March 2019, only $127 million of the famous pool will be supported by government in the same way. Not if you think that the two things may well reply to it, but the money is somewhere else. What is the government system on offer the government system reserves and voting? I will refuse this information. I'm not suspicious of any time I come to the Parliament, but I will refuse the information. Mr. Speaker, what we are doing, rather honestly, is rising recurrent expenditure, rising net debt, decreasing revenue, and decreasing cash balances. Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid to say this, but you see we're heading for sober reckoning with financial reality, and we need to wake up to this now. Mr. Speaker, the world bodes well, but it gets worse, I'm afraid. The first time that we've had a meeting in this house, the government is actually anticipating what we call a budget deficit. In that, the closing of the Federal Reserve Fund Reserve is lower than the opening balance. The outcome from March 2018. Rather than a surplus for this year, the economy has actually shown a deficit of $4.9 million, which is mainly due to an extra £21 million required for improvement and development, the improvement and development funds, which is big in itself is recorded at $7.6 million deficit, and that is written deficit in their own book. That the community care contribution for 2018 is not the usual $20 million as it has been for the last 2 years, though it will be cut by 25%. That is to be cut a quarter to the next level under the government to $15 million. It is going to be very significant. In the local government is actually now underfunding community care. The total cost in 2014, which is not the count I have available to me, was $15 million. The insecure, really, the numbers are not too significant. We have a chief minister coming away today with some information as to the growth in eligible pensioners, which we stated in 2009 was 8,213, and 2018 was 11,693. So I can't see that the community care budget will be decreasing. The other question, which I think the numbers are probably wrong, the community care will have to be eating into reserves to fund its expenses. I just think it's not so that the Honourable Farmer has mentioned new people editorial, but the government should be taking a contribution to hold the community care. And if we need to care, we have to have the first thing I think is very loud. And we really need to get into the rain day fund. It's a thing I've got to say. It's a 2019. The government's going to be projecting a very large forward budget deficit of $19 million. Without taking into account its contribution to community care, even a 2018 level of $15 million. It's bigger. The government will, for the first time, actually project a depletion of our reserves. If we need, Mr. Speaker, a deficit budget. But if the improvement development fund, the picture is not much better. It has to be much worse. The improvement development fund in 2018 is being increased. Since that from an opening balance of £7.9 million, the thing that's doing nothing more than £319,000. The speaker, the function of the improvement development fund, and actually, I want to say to include in 2019, that the balance is only anticipated to grow by £100,000, which some say the figure is peanuts. This is bigger. For real, it is the improvement in development fund, which is part of the debt warrant for this budget, if it needed one. I don't think the government has the colonial bookkeeper's technical analysis. I wanted to speak to a member say, hey, well, I'm trying to do one, but now I don't really much. And it's simply the fact that we have this project's fantastic management for speaker. This fact is that the room, which is people on three for all the time. Of the 1,000 pounds, if it's either 1,000 pounds, there is no, I repeat, no provision for the cost of the construction or the opening schools which are then already disclosed. The new population will cost $52.2 million. Nothing. If you have six schools actually built on a conservative estimate of say, well, $15 million each, that's simple spend, you can have $42.2 million. Where is this in the book? Can you see this in the book? Because I can't find it. The government is not in their book. How much can a standoff? And as a temerity to spread in the record purposes, we're not in a country most respectable. It's an option. And it's a figure of the law. We're not provision for a 20 million wastewater treatment plant. Again, over 1,000 pounds. I don't see that voice in life. We're going to be working around the problem here. So where's the fact? What's the problem? We don't have to talk about that budget. Can we put it in 20 million? Can we put it in 52 million? How can we figure that? Because everyone has a good purpose, maybe a worse purpose. It's awful. The whole project, Mr. Speaker, when it was reported in the Freedom Development Fund, was the 2019 final date. And Mr. Speaker, I would like to say, unsurprisingly, this is already significantly over budget. Over budget for 16 and a half million, with no loss for it. And Mr. Speaker, I think you're wrong. There's nothing in respect to the national paper. There's nothing in respect to the Grand Prix of Belfast scheme. Mr. Speaker, even if the government came back with a supplementary appropriation bill next year, to this moment, we simply do not have it. Either whether the disclosure is done, or the improvement is done, and then it's going to be 2019. We need to make up the figure. I'm going to check
County, especially the affordable housing scheme. I think it has to be the matter of the people. And that's because, when I am a conservative estimate of 200 million, we are going to do that, even for the Chief Minister, given the current state of our finances of our just that time. We are saying, Mr. Speaker, that the nation of housing will have been using this respect for the last. We're not people put too much stuff in her words. Especially as you said, not only the last few budget speeches in regard to both of these views, but I think that's really in the process, Mr. Speaker. And because there are many things you're talking for reasons of infrastructure. Infrastructure is an important preliminary issue. And we want to get all the detail rights before making any further announcements.
is aware of unexpected calls in government expenditure or unpredictable drops in revenue. End quote. The old true government revenue fund but this is, as the reason suggests, the contingency fund. 21 of Section 21 of the Constitution, which for a number of years has held a poultry fund of £400,000. Now, to begin with, what is this? So that's what they have, I think. I would say that the government wants to see need, and to see need for expenditure, which no other provision exists, to make the advances in that fund to meet that need. End quote. That, Mr. Speaker, was remarkably like the GSLP liberal definition of a rainy day fund. Mr. Speaker, it is evidently not being funded. Mr. Speaker, the Federal House wants to throw away money in different places. Every 5 years, a regular has been to break in 1 month in the Treasury, and not even the government's property. Or perhaps, Mr. Speaker, he just does not trust the government, including his own, not to understand. Mr. Speaker, the self-appointed government community chair is described as a rolling fund in the GSLP Liberal Manifesto. However, it is the first evident truth that something less presentable to the government could meet additional funding requirements. The only way to do that, Mr. Speaker, is a total money to pay pensioners. But the government ought to meet its recurrent obligations. It's not only their fund, Mr. Speaker, but the government. It can't be access to those resources you're funding. To healthcare, education, housing, or any other needs of the community, Mr. Speaker. If we're not going to draw our own people on the 17th of May 2019, for my part, many times community care nonsense, end quote. The following idea was put forward, and I thought, should the bank be hit by the period of low revenue, this income will be protected by the fact that the trustees have this rainy day fund available to them. But the beginning to fund these payments dependent on the time when the government might not work, will be able to fund the payments of growth. The trustees of community care would be relieved to tax time or the need to make these payments. Hence, the principal reason why the community care funds can probably be classed as a rainy day fund for the people in Gibraltar, end quote. Yes, Mr. Speaker, it is a community care rainy day fund if the government fails to meet its obligations. It could be, and if not, the government rainy day fund, and to continue to describe it as such is utter nonsense. If the government were a company, because when the spending on the investment, that would, of course,
haven't had a student. After the question, so it was followed by no, given that this is because it was not working for staffing. I was saying, how do I know that my own is against my government? How do I know? I will gladly ask the top team to please respond to my letter. As soon as possible, I believe in the hotel to take a public interest where they are investing the 100 million that I am. My name is Jesse Chiu, my name is Cameron, and it's time for a public, and we are invited to my hotel. I look at the hotel to take a public interest to hear their funding, any government or private sector, real estate service. And this money is held in Britain local, it is not local. Or it is liquid, I'd like to know where it is. I could not speak of the football back to touch, and that session, by the honorable comment of the people that I thought were able to draw the ball behind as to whether the money was indeed or not, because of the other more saying about it. We need to learn that I could not speak of it. I don't think that all grants, that the reserves of the penny back is false. Indeed, and then they as they are indeed available to them. It's because of other contractual projections of the reserve and savings bank will be 20 million by 2019-20. It's because the government's final preference can be foreign. The final term of it as the reserve are projected to be only 41 million in 1919. With an annual surplus of £4 million in 1919. The federal bank will have to make a regulatory surplus profit of £30 million in 1920, or 2019-2020, to meet the bailout manifesto commitment. This is bigger, it's going to have to miss the target by a large margin. Gibraltar was zero. That's not clear to people. When the GDP left office in 2011, the government had £234 million in official reserves and an indirect debt of £285 million. This is because in 2019, the government predicted official reserves of only £96 million and an indirect debt of £339.9 million. I'm sure we can all do the math. Cash down, debt. Is this not a precursor to a fresh country when you get funds and a devoted fund that you haven't drawn on ever before? It's the net improvement. Don't see it. That's the bigger. The net improvement does not work. I don't know. Please tell me where it is. Why didn't we create an office? That is the more contentious perhaps in the question of what is under the level of public debt, and is indeed the primary question that arises in these debates. A first call is because I would ask GDC to correct the information on their website, where they say that net debt is down 1% to 324 million. I think she's been for concern, that's not right, in fact, net debt. It was up 2.6% from 2017 to 18, from 324 million to, sorry, from 315 million to 324 million. I think the reason for that is because it's been rather roundabout way where the people who prefer compare our net debt figure to GDP and that's where the computer is written. But in real terms, this is true, yes, I think it's better. From 415 million to 324 million. I want to think of the events of Brandon's and Bank. It's been a lot of research from the principal auditor's report for 1415, talking about the presence of a value bank. I said, Mr. Speaker, the increase of 204
2.2 million that appears to be there, and many of the results of the issue of short-term funds debentures, including our first year, the replacement debentures for balance of diversity debentures that were in the day. So this is again, what Mr. Bafaro of Canada and Bill Bafaro are referring to. But what is the type, as the honorable my honorable colleague has referred to, a transfer of debt from the government book to those books on the paper bank? So let's begin. The civil premise has this been joined to the bank. And I'll simply ask this. And that is for the question to be settled, which I don't think is wrong, reasonable request. I certainly would welcome a strong review from a specialized body, such as, for example, the UK Charter Institute of Public Finance and Accountancy, which is their speciality. But because of the official gross direct debt of the government of Gibraltar is £447.7 million. £322.8 million, as at the 31st of March 2018. Which, if we go ahead and offer £247.7 million of the debentures issued by the government prepared by the same bank, which I understand has no such maturity, and £200 million of bank borrowing. The bank borrowing is included in the Rochester information available to me, is around £50 million by March, maturing in March 2020, £150 million by Barclays, maturing in tranche of £100 million in January 2019, and £50 million in June 2020. And if you got a note, and I'm hopeful as to what Chief Minister said this morning about seeking extension of those maturities. Since last year, I tried to quantify indirect debt. And this year, I come up with the following. Credit finance, $400 million in the bank. GDP in that facility. Like their number now, $15 million in the Gibraltar International Bank, securing government property. EX Limited, the private owner of our currency station, $55 million PLC. Gibraltar Capital Access Limited, $300 million, low notes between the 6,000 of them. This is bigger than us, containing $721 million, in addition to the official gross debt of $447.7 million, which is taken to the official gross debt of $1.27 million, as at the 31st of March 2019. But it's bigger this year. I need to add a new element. That is in the form of the Gibraltar Development Corporation. We have, in fact, borrowed $30 million from government owned companies, and we also borrowed $13 million of B-shares in the Gibraltar International Bank. Obviously, that I have no doubt that this injection of capital is needed and justified. It's the level of the funding that I find unusual. At the beginning of the morning, the Chief Minister said that, well, this $30 million came from a $300 million borrowing. That's the first we hear this, Mr. Speaker. I think it begs the question, why don't the beach shares pay for why the improvements in development funds? So, the good news is that the reason for it is actually the usual ubiquitous £1,000 allowance in the improved development funds. Why don't the speaker that if we don't get that, we can't even get a deficit in the control of the funds and higher net. The government was concerned about increasing the deficit. It was meant to be covered by a figure of times for 30 million. So the same thing to deserve, which I'm sorry, makes it sense to take place. But now it's just been there. What is 30 million needed? It's a grand new fund. This is difficult to explain politically, and we're in the government's manifesto. The 30 million comes from the 300 million. We still don't know why we owe 230 million. We still don't know. Chief Minister, I don't care if you owe to us. The government will lose recognition for today. Not his money, not my money, not our money, but the people's money. And people's debt, more importantly. So let's think of the solution that's so simple. Get the GDP to borrow the money and buy the fuel. Simple. Don't go on debt. The government is going to get funds.
the ultimate in financial trickery and reinforces my argument that our financial system and budget have been reduced to a farce, Mr. Speaker, by this government. I'm not going to have a government overseas machine.
condominium, and then through their mail term, and that's an agreement by which the landlord holders rent their interest together. And the government refuses to provide recognition or property, and the public placement online that is setting out the sales of landlords. The government says the landlord holders get more information than we do in this power. The reason I'm already saying we still don't have the latest report from the Prince of Water. The report from the U.S. Internet Center for the 31st of July 2017 on my Friday. I think it's been a pretty hard to approve a total budget to 1.7 million in 2019 because I'm struggling. I have no faith in that financial statement. I was asking to my commission what is down the 31st of December 2017 financial. Responsibility for public sector efficiency under the Father of House was indeed something that we welcomed at the time. I think the findings that the Father of House came up with earlier this afternoon, which is, I suppose, worse, smarter, not harder, was perhaps something that the government should have embraced in the every department. Including a few critical events. I've seen measurable evidence of success today from the Department for Public Sector Efficiency. As a result of this, we can be the use of private sector office space. On the 1st of January 2017, the government entered into a 12-year lease, 12-year lease, speaker, for 3,300 £100,000 per annum, which was originally figured to be used by the Savings Bank. We then spent £216,222 and one. Well, it's worth noting, and the figure is about three small, spent in a boarded up and empty. Boarded up and empty. And the Art Department relocated into the World Trade Center. Why would the Department for Public Safety? So we must spend a minimum of 1.4 million on 323 Main Street on a 12 million, which is 14 million people, and on the Art Department, which is the office space of the World Trade Center. It's
what people say about it.
And then, unfortunately, the book can tell which one's not authority.
The most of the help we think is passing the budget speech last year.
And regretfully, I will remind you of it, I suppose.
And she will say, as part of the financial year of hope,
and all his words, Mr. Speaker,
in my view, I am a possible deficit. My commitment to our taxpayers is that when I first year minister for health, the GDP will come within budget by improving healthcare.
Mr. Speaker, again, the GDP will come within budget.
Mr. Speaker, I regret to say the GDP will definitely make things coming from £9.6 million over budget. Over budget, Mr. Speaker. And this could be despite having a better budget. I was impressed by all this work. Mostly mentioned on the first Friday week after the turn of the month, the whole week of the where we review every single line of expenditure line by line. There is a $500 million $5 for next to all the reasons. Being taken to ensure that this month will reflect expenditure within budget. Well, I'm always a speaker. I'm sure the Minister of Health wouldn't like enough when he gives his budget speech. But Mr. Speaker, to be fair to the Minister of Health, was my personal view that this last year's GDP budget was fine, and fine, unrealistic, despite the Minister's best effort and budgetary control for the Bank of England. But Mr. Speaker, not to disappoint this year, it will cost the Minister of the Culture. Who, Mr. Speaker, is to know what a budget is? And the other thing means blessing from the Father of God. Mr. Speaker, he not content with exceeding his budget last year on the 2017 media platform by £1.6 million with a double up in the world. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. He has reached the record with a wide or a bit of book of representative at the American level. The people in the record were in all the countries. That's it, Mr. Speaker. Our budget was regular. That's £2.6 million. Mr. Speaker, as I mentioned last year,
business licensing continues to be an issue, needing a simplification, especially in the regard business premises and funds. Now, I know the Federation of Small Businesses and the Chamber are working closely with the government on this matter, and I hope progress will be made soon. The recently published consultation paper on key legislation affecting businesses and commerce is, of course, to be praised and welcomed. We need to reduce obstacles to business and promote encouragement, not just incentives to business, especially in the startup. As a speaker, the introduction of concepts of pensions is something to welcome. I look forward to hearing the views of both the unions and the Chamber and the Federation on the best way to introduce them. I trust the government will come up with a workable bill after the end of the consultation period, and I look forward to the debate in due course. As a speaker, the world of telecommunications has never been so competitive. And I really do now have a particular interest in Jim Telecom's financial performance. Not just because it's a bit of half of my portfolio responsibilities, but also because the savings bank is its sole shareholder. I'm able to think of a Jim Telecom as being best to diversify its product range from fixed line to data storage and recently on demand TV. I'm, however, disappointed that December 2016 audit of financial statements. I'm not yet available to you, I understand some technical accounting issues, but all of them I am told are resolving. Mr. Speaker, Jim Telecom board of accounts are usually uploaded on my website promptly every year. I look forward to them being finalized soon. Mr. Speaker, I am actually interested in Jim Telecom's plans for the Holding Fight. This was purchased from the government in 2014. For £5.8 million, partly funded by way of a bank loan, and it's been empty ever since. In 2015, an application was made to DPC for a two-story extension to be built on the Haven site. But now, Mr. Speaker, this has been replaced since March 2019 with a new plan, which means just refurbishment of the existing structure and then extension. Speaker, there's going to be forthcoming annual report, which has lights on the plans of Avon and the associated costs, and I look forward to reading the 2016 annual report in due course. Speaker, last and not least, I welcome the publication of the long overdue heritage and activity bill. I have already had the opportunity with my colleague, Mr. Travanos, to have a constructive discussion on the bill with our Minister for Heritage, and if we can all not anticipate anything that will be said in the forthcoming debate, I will be looking at that. Your question very much to do on heritage, and I note the comments made by the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister as to the idea to enhance the Northern Defence Force. I also look forward to hearing more from the Minister for Heritage as to plans for the World Cup. I will not be a party to the travesty of the government called a budget president's budget. Mr. Speaker, I accuse the government of failing to produce a meaningful budget and prudent estimate book for 2018-19. I say I have proven it has been not included the cost of the new school. And let us see when reserves are being depleted. Mr. Speaker, I accuse the government of failing to meet basic standards of transparency and accountability in public finance. And so I approve. In other words, there's a lack of information given on government companies and indeed how the $300 million mortgage money is being used. I accuse the Chief Minister of being down to say, of its business state of affairs in respect of our public finances, and not just figure out there is a failure in teaching place and plan. And it's because people are very much children to responsibility. And they're wrong. Mr. Speaker,
the world for the word of truth on a meaningful basis. Almost best for this budget, Mr. Speaker, not because of petty party line politics, but because we've seen what they do is neither complete nor accurate. Mr. Speaker, the rent will not go out, the schools will not close, and people will not die, as we received in the suggested last year, because of our voting against this budget. We are appreciating, Mr. Speaker, to hold on to account on behalf of the people of Gibraltar, and not only measuring them in that duty, and we stand the ground down to determine the time for government, and the government. I stand by my accusation, and we're going to have to stay here, back to the budget. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, Mr. Speaker, I'll move the house now again to tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. Tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.